Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 7th, 2018. This Saturday's class is the week 11 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is on rebirth. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Joe. How are you guys? We're talking about rebirth today. This is the 11th week of our 12-week course. The Buddha describes an awakened human being very clearly and very simply. He states that an awakened human being understands at a profound penetrating level the nature of stress, the nature of dukkha, which makes sense because that's what the Buddha set out to describe and to hopefully bring to cessation our contributions to that. And then he further describes that quality of mind as calm or peaceful or resting in equanimity. These aren't qualities of mind that are beyond a human being's capability to develop. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for human beings to develop, and he taught that development could occur in one lifetime. And that relates to how well we integrate and continue to practice his Dhamma, which makes sense, doesn't it? He didn't teach anything that could not be directly experienced in this moment, provided we have the level of concentration and the refined mindfulness to notice it. In other words, we have to have a framework to notice our own development within the Dhamma. But the Dhamma provides that framework. It gives us very clear guidance through the Eightfold Path of what we're to develop and what we're to simply put aside. And this teaching on karma and rebirth is exactly part of that. It's nothing conceptual. It's entirely practical. So the most important aspect to remember about rebirth is we're not talking about doing things to manipulate a more pleasurable future birth, because that's really this kind of thing that we're doing in our own life rooted in wrong view. We're always hoping to manipulate an environment in a way that it can't be manipulated, to provide constant satisfaction to an ego self, or to put aside any concern or any aversion that we might have to life. It's a matter of developing a calm and peaceful mind. And that calm and peaceful mind is developed through radical acceptance of what's occurring. And we've all learned, or most of us have learned now, the profound difference between acceptance and approval. A mind resting in equanimity knows that approval or disapproval has no bearing on a well-lived life. But acceptance of life as life occurs is the essence of a well-lived human life. Okay. These are my words, and I'm going to get to a couple of quotes. An awakened mind, free of craving and clinging, peacefully experiences life as life occurs with no limiting or stress-reducing self-referential thoughts or actions. A self-referential thought is a thought that is reflected by the use of the word anatta. The Buddha used that word not to describe an environment of emptiness or nothingness, or that there's no such thing as a self. He simply used that term, common in his time, but in an uncommon way, to describe and remind us that the views we're holding to describe a self in reference to the world we live in do not accurately describe a self. They're not a self. That's how the Buddha used the term, meaning let go of those views. And a wrong view and a right view cannot coexist in a mind resting in equanimity. You can see the stress if we're trying to hold on to an old view, a view rooted in ignorance, and then trying to fit in an awakened or fully mature view. It doesn't work. It creates incredible stress in our minds. Hopefully we get to the point where we are our minds are well concentrated enough and we have integrated the Eightfold Path so that it becomes a natural expression of recognizing when a thought is inclining towards an unskillful or unproductive way of looking at the world and bring that back into the framework of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha states, intention, I tell you, is karma. Remember that right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging as it arises. And so obviously the only way that we can notice craving and clinging as it arises so that we can bring it to cessation is to be present with it as it's arising, isn't it? We have to develop a way to be comfortable looking at our views that are resulting in stress and also embracing or developing those views that lead to awakening. That points to the importance of what we're giving birth to in each moment. And that relates to the quality of mind. It relates to what we're holding in mind will determine what we bring into our own existence. One does karma by way of body, speech, and intellect, relating directly to those behavioral factors of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And what is the result of karma? The result of karma is of three sorts, I tell you. That which arises right here and now, that which arises later, and that which arises following that. So the Buddha is directly showing us here in this statement that what we're dealing with is what's arising, what's coming to fruition in our life. That's what's important. To be able to focus on the immediate experience and relate it to the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. That's where true vision comes. It comes from an immediate mindful presence of our life as our life occurs, without the distraction of needing it to be any different than it is, than what's arising in this moment. Again, the difference between acceptance and approval.
Yes. I don't understand what you just said.
I don't either. So.
Karma is what is arising now, and after that, and after that. I don't understand that. You can only hold one thing in mind at one time.
There's also a reference here to the diversity of karma, where it's not. This is where John Lennon was wrong. All karma is an instant. It doesn't naturally the momentum of our unskillful intentions in the past, if they all manifested at once, there would be no way to deal with it. It would just be overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so the vagaries of impermanence, the impermanence isn't the something to resist. Impermanence creates stress in our lives because of holding on to things, creating a fixed, permanent view of things. But impermanence also describes the true nature of things, meaning that things are always in a constant process of developing or becoming. Karma is the same way. And so the Buddha is saying that our karma can manifest right now, and it is. We can't help that. But the effects of our karma will manifest over a period of time. And there's no determining factor. That's simply part of the life we live. What is most important is that what we're holding in mind will determine our experience with our own karma. So karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by the level of our mindfulness. And so if we have a measure of refined mindfulness, then we can deal with our karma as it unfolds in a calm and peaceful way and so not contribute to any further karma. But if we're constantly reacting to what's arising through conditioned mind, you could call karma is another word and a slightly different description of a conditioned mind or a mind rooted in ignorance. It's also a description of the ongoing experience of anatta or the ongoing experience of five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates simply describe an ongoing personal experience of suffering, and karma is a word that describes the momentum that's maintaining these five clinging aggregates. And so through mindfulness, through refined mindfulness, we can recognize the process as it unfolds, and through right intention, unravel the process of dependent origination, always producing the result of what we're holding in mind. That's a profound understanding of dependent origination. And it's what the Buddha awakened to. He stated upon his awakening that if our minds are rooted in ignorance through 12 observable causative links, it can only produce something known as dukkha. But But a mind rooted in the wisdom of an awakened human being will start producing moments that are inclining the mind towards awakening. And so even if you look at it that way, with it is within the process of karma unfolding that we develop awakening. So karma is not good or bad. And that's the problem with striving to manipulate karma to have better karma in the future, is simply establishing a self-referential ego cell, what is prone to suffering, in a future event. It's simply a way of hanging on to wrong views, that notion of manipulating good karma. Or even the belief that karma is bad, that, oh, I had a bad day, there's a dark cloud over me, I must have bad karma. Or even thinking that what occurred to me in a negative way is the result, a direct result of punishment because I've done something hurtful in the past. That's just not true. That's not how karma works. It's not how Buddha taught karma. It's not a zero-sum game. It doesn't mean that if I've done something egregious in a moment, that at some point in a future, in this life or a future life, I have to receive the exact same experience. It's just nonsense. It doesn't allow for impermanence. It doesn't allow for awakening, does it? And the perfect example of that, and there's many in the suttas, is the Buddha's encounter with Angulimala. I talked about this past week. Angulimala, the murderer who murdered 99 people. He was a bloodthirsty human being. He used to cut the fingers off and make a necklace out of it. And so one day, Angulimala has 99 fingers hanging off his neck, and blood off him. And he's walking down the street looking for number 100. And he sees the Buddha coming the other way. And that's number 100. I can't wait to get to him. And there's a long, I won't get into the whole sutta, but he has difficulty approaching the Buddha until he's right upon the Buddha. And the Buddha's presence holds him back. He's struck by this awakened human being. And he doesn't act immediately. The Buddha understood where Angulimala was coming from and presented the Dhamma to him in a very succinct way. Angulimala understood it, awakened, became one of the most important, well, not one of the most, he became an important monk in the Buddhist Sangha. But the most important thing is that Angulimala died a peaceful life, and he didn't now have to experience being murdered 99 times to balance the so-called scales of justice. What he needed to bring his own suffering to cessation was to awaken. And that momentum that was driving him to experience the anguish of his own violence and competitiveness, at that moment his mind cleared. There's nothing left to karmically drive any further suffering for him. And there's no overarching spiritual system of behavior modification to now say, well, we can't let Angulimala get away with this, so let me kill him 99 times. And where it doesn't even make sense within the Buddha's Dhamma. If you're awakened, you're awakened. You're no longer contributing to your own suffering or the suffering of others. And it really is that simple. When the Buddha talks about, there's a phrase that he would often use, a wise, awakened human being understands the danger in even the slightest transgression. What he's referring to is the danger of not addressing your karma, what you've created in your own life. Did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
And another long-winded answer, but it was important. And what is the result of karma? Let me read this again. The result of karma is of three sorts: that which arises right here and now, that which arises later, and what he's talking about is later in this lifetime, and that which arises following that, meaning he's not discounting the possibility of a future life, but he's relating to that future life is nothing different than what's arising right here in this lifetime. It's simply a progression of a mind rooted in ignorance. And what is the cessation of karma? From the cessation of contact is the cessation of karma. So that, again, this is something that could be confusing unless it's taken out of context. It doesn't mean that we have to completely cut off contact with the physical world. How would we do that? It's contact still rooted in that ignorance. Remember the series we went to on practicing restraint. At that point of contact, at where stress is arising, it's at that point that we practice the Dhamma and we practice restraint and we practice diminishing eye-making. At the point of contact. Where, how else would we do it? This is how we relate to the outside world. The outside world comes through our experience, first through contact. And then if our consciousness is rooted in ignorance, that contact is interpreted through that ignorant view. change the view, and the interpretation of contact changes too, doesn't it? If that view is resting in equanimity, if it's not a self-referential view, then there's no self to be affected in that moment, is it? That's the mind of an awakened human being. It's a mind resting in peace and equanimity. There's no self-reference, meaning I don't need this moment to be any different than it is because there's no me in it. I'm not taking it personal. The Buddha taught how to develop a dispassionate, impersonal response to life because we understand the nature of impermanence. And we understand the inherent struggles of having a human life, so we don't react to it anymore. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of karma. And just the Noble Eightfold Path of right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, these are the Buddha's words, is the path of practice leading to the cessation of karma. And the Buddha never taught another path of practice, did he? At least during his physical life, there's some claims that he taught different paths in a disincarnate form. All of those forms contradict what he taught while he was in physical form. And what I found is that what he taught in the physical form as preserved in the Sutta Pitaka is a clear and direct path towards awakening. And again, he started his teaching career by teaching the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta that established the Four Noble Truths for the first time in human history. And then everything he taught in the remaining 45 years of his teaching career was taught in that context of Four Noble Truths and in the context of dependent origination. And why would he teach anything else? He declared over and over again, I teach the understanding of suffering and the cessation of suffering. And he would often conclude that, again, these are Pali words, but saying nothing more. But when you understand the profound nature of that, there is nothing more to understand. If we want to live a human lives in peace and equanimity, and cease creating the conditions that drive disappointing, unsatisfactory, in a word, dukkha, drive those types of experience. We're the ones that are responsible for that, not some outside agency or a grand spiritual system. It's up to us, according to an awakened human being. Now, when a noble disciple discerns karma in this way, the cause by which karma comes into play in this way, the diversity of karma in this way, the result of karma in this way, the cessation of karma in this way, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of karma in this way, then he discerns that penetrative, integrative life as the cessation of karma. It's living the life. As we integrate and develop the Eightfold Path, we are living that life that is designed towards bringing karma to cessation. And how do we know it? Well, an awakened human being did it if we truly take refuge. Now, this is the meaning of taking refuge in the Ratana Sutta. We take refuge in the understanding that a human being actually did this, proved it. This human being left his Dhamma for us to understand. And we are, especially here, we are so fortunate to have a well-focused Sangha that develops that Dhamma. That is taking true refuge. And what other refuge, the Buddha would say, uses those words, whatever refuge could there be? Except bringing the individual that is prone to suffering into this refuge. He's talking about creating the refuge for ourselves as individuals by accepting the fact that up until this point, my experience has been rooted in wrong view. Relates directly to the beginning of the Eightfold Path. With the cessation of karma comes the cessation of rebirth of the five clinging aggregates. Again, it points directly to the Dhamma, not to something magical or mystical that may or may not occur. When we integrate the Eightfold Path and take responsibility for the karma that's unfolding in our life, through the Eightfold Path, we can bring to cessation the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience rooted in ignorance of suffering. Does everybody see that, how it directly affects the problem, and the Buddha is describing how to do it? Is that clear? Yes, no? Don't shake your head, because I can't really see if you're shaking your head.
Yes.
Okay, no questions? Karma is the suffering of continually giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Rooted in ignorance These are my words, not the Buddha's. One can only become further ignorant. Makes sense, doesn't it? So if we accept the basic premise of what the Buddha is teaching, and we don't have, nobody has to, you know, but if my way of thinking after many years of trying to figure out what this was all about was, if I'm going to follow what an awakened human being taught, I should first try to find out what it is. And by the way, that's possible. We're experiencing it. And then I should make an effort to integrate that into my life as opposed to something else. And I remember going through this many, many years ago, because I was deeply conditioned and entrenched in both the Tibetan traditions and Zen traditions. And so I had, because of the effort put in, it's natural to create an attachment and try to make those views that are contradictory to what is presented in the Sutta Pitakas. I want to hold on to these views, but introduce these new views. It doesn't work because they are so contradictory. They have a different purpose and focus. When I finally realized that, it gave me the freedom to start letting go of these old views that no longer serve me. And again, I'm not putting down any other tradition. These are well-established religions that work well for millions of people. For me as an individual, they didn't work anymore. They didn't provide me what the Buddha promised they should bring, and that's really what made the difference. I realized that a human being would teach something that a human being could understand readily and develop themselves. And I found that was what the Buddha taught. And he taught it in this way. He taught this to be mindful of what's occurring in our life in relation to the Eightfold Path. And if we do that, we can awaken. We can develop the mind of a Buddha. We can become Buddha, hence the name of the book. The Buddha didn't teach that he was separate from us or he had any special qualities that allowed him to do this. He never held himself above other human beings. He described himself simply this way, as a Tathagata, which means, I went forth from the world, but I'm the first one to do it. Everyone in the Arahant Sutta, he describes this clearly, everyone that follows from that point and develops the awakening of a Buddha is now an Arahant, which describes the same quality of mind. The only difference is, you didn't do it first. And that's an important distinction to remember where this came from. It brings the Dhamma outside of a mystical and maybe seemingly unattainable practice to understanding that this is for human beings, and it, because a human being did it, and he taught us how to do it. He never set himself up as a god. He never set himself up in any superior way. He always resisted that when people tried to do it. And it's interesting that after in the second Buddhist council is when these notions of establishing the Buddha in a higher, it's not the right word, establishing the Buddha in a view that made him superhuman or godlike is where the split between what the Buddha taught, this is from the Mahasanghika sect, they wanted a much more visionary type of Dhamma. They were very influenced by the Vedas that were prominent at the time. And so they wanted to establish the Buddha as a Buddha, as one Buddha among many Buddhas that have been established in limitless eons going back to the past, and there's limitless eons in the future, and there's limitless Buddhas. Well, the Buddha never taught that. And I would think, at least there's no accounting of that. And you would think that an awakened human being would make a point of that if it was important. When the Buddha awakened, I talked about this last week, he awakened, there's a picture of him holding his hand up this way, his left hand at a solar plexus, and his right hand touching the ground, symbolizing that, and his words were, I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no more future births. He's declaring and showing that an awakened human being is no longer stuck in this environment of samsara that is prone to sickness, aging, and death. It's prone to suffering. The Eightfold Path provides the framework and guidance to be mindful of karma and to cease giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. The Eightfold Path provides the framework and guidance to become Buddha. That's the end of the article, and hence the conclusion of that chapter. That's the end of the talk. Is there any questions directly on this? Because when I go around the room, I'm going to ask you if you understand it. Kevin.
It's interesting when you said becoming Buddha, and as you mentioned in the past, the word, the concepts associated with that. I think when you say sometimes it means becoming awakened, you know, Buddha means awakened. So
yes.
Becoming awakened to this process of personalizing worldly phenomena in this life or in this experience, right? You know, we look for this karma discussion or kama discussion looks for something after that. Get to that and hold that in mind.
Yes.
Binds the five linking aggregates and then binds the whole process.
Yep.
And then we're living in equanimity and the best we can. Life occurs.
Yeah. That's exactly what the Buddha taught and how he taught it. To do it now. You know, Ehepasiko, I've had that. It's a featured talk on the website because something came up with an online student. Everything the Buddha taught was to be experienced individually. There's nothing that he never taught that anything, and he never taught that understanding could be bestowed on us. I know that there's traditions, the Zen tradition is, and some Tibetan traditions are, they rely on something called mind-to-mind transmission, which may be entirely possible. I'm not discounting that that's not possible. What I am saying is it's not something that the Buddha ever taught, and it would contradict what he taught, because the Buddha taught that this is an individual process of developing understanding. Nothing can be bestowed on us. The only thing that a teacher can do is to point us in the direction of the Dhamma and encourage us to maintain integrity with the Dhamma. After all, this is what an awakened human being taught, and not be confused by other things. Thank you, Kevin. Any other questions? And now I'm going to put you on the spot. So if you have any questions, just give me a brief description of your understanding of karma and rebirth, just for a couple. And if you don't want to, it's okay too, but I'd like to hear it. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Sitting here this morning, karma is something I don't dwell on in my thoughts about when I'm thinking about the Buddha practice. I, as much as you say there's nothing magical or mystical about the Buddha words and all that sort of stuff, there's something about karma that I just don't touch in my thoughts. I just can't touch it and really understand it and integrate it into my this moment or my next moment. I understand it when you say that it's your past thoughts have brought you to this point and that will have a momentum onto the next moment, etc., which is what karma is. But there's a lot of what you said this morning that I really can't touch in my thinking, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you spoke about the five clinging aggregates. It bumps up to the five clinging aggregates if you understand karma. I can understand the five clinging aggregates. I can understand how that is in my thinking, how it makes me think about how I think about myself. And it shows the ways that I think about myself incorrectly, which is the five clinging aggregates. I can see that, and I think I can understand a lot of what you said. What you do say, but there's something about karma. I don't think I'm holding on to pre-learned teachings, because since I came here I never took much notice of the word karma anyway. So I don't think I'm really holding on to, I'm not confused in that sense. It's just in the sense that the Buddha describes karma, I really can't wrap my head around it just yet. You're smiling away though.
No,
what does that mean?
I like how you finished it, just yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's because you're holding on to something else that's blocking you. I think it's just understanding karma is part, is really understanding the Dhamma. But also, we tend to make even words that we don't understand. There's some resistance to understanding, to developing that. And karma is simply describes what's occurring in our life. It has, there's not much usefulness of the term beyond that. I mean, it has some societal connotations that are rather powerful and they condition our minds, but that's not how the Buddha taught it. And that might be where the difficulty for all of us comes, to recognize that karma is just describing. In that way, it's more conceptual than something as saying the five clinging aggregates, because we can look within ourselves and see that. Mm-hmm. But to karma is so close to us that it's hard to see. Mm-hmm. Karma is anatta. Karma is dukkha. Karma is five clinging aggregates. But it's simply describing the overall environment of a mind wandering around in ignorance. That's all. And so if you're not yet awakened, it's useful to understand karma as simply the experience that you're having. And that you can take that experience and frame it within right view and use that, the experience of what's occurring right now, to awaken. A good example of that would be something that occurs that agitates my mind. If my mind is agitated in this moment, it's because of karma. It's because of past intentional actions that have conditioned my mind to the extent that it's causing a reaction in this moment. That's karma. That's the experience of karma. It's just describing or a reminder that the reason why I'm agitated or distracted in this moment is because I am carrying the baggage of thinking in the past. That's all it is. It's not describing, or it's not causing the event that would obviate the Dhamma. Mm. It's not describing the event, it's describing my experience of the event. Mm. Because any experience can be seen as, from a self-referential ego point of view, as wonderful or not so wonderful. I like it or I don't like it. An awakened human being sees that same experience as simply an experience. It's what's occurred. I don't need it to be any different because it can't be any different. How could it? How could something, the Buddha's saying that if it's occurred, how could it be different? So why would you want it to be different? It's just pure logic, isn't it?
It's stuffed, yeah.
Yeah, no matter what it is. And that mind that is now resting in equanimity will no longer contribute to the dis-ease in the world because it's resting in equanimity. It's no longer creating the conditions that bring rise to a agitated mind to itself, and it's no longer capable of bringing suffering to others intentionally. Now, that doesn't mean that as an awakened human being, your actions will have no effect. Your being at peace might be agitating to someone who wishes you weren't, but what can you do? Do you see? Okay. Any other questions about that?
Not about karma, no, but I can go on a little bit further.
Please.
Last week I spoke about when I was making a project, putting it together.
Hmm.
I got all, anatta, sort of like, got an explosion of importance and all that sort of stuff. And then, lo and behold, this week, it's occurred again in another sort of frame, that I've learned some knowledge that's going to be helpful to me, very helpful to me in the future. And once I understood the knowledge, got it, I couldn't let it go. I had to like thrash it to death and think about, you know, anatta just got a whole explosion again. And with on another sutta, not today's teaching, but you know, you say that, what is it you you see what you see, you hear what you hear, and there's no sort of follow on after it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I've noticed the big follow on of aggravated anatta after learning knowledge, which is going to be helpful for me. I've noticed that in my mind. It's been, which goes back to the point that I'm not in control of my mind, which means I'm out of control of my mind, which means I'm out of my mind.
But it, out of your mind in a very normal way.
Yes.
It's the common problem. You referred to the Bahia Sutta, where the Buddha teaches Bahia, that in what is seen, there is only what is seen. In what is heard, there is only what is heard. In what is cognized, there is only what is cognized.
Mm.
And think about it. Again, you can take, if you understand the overarching Dhamma, that's the whole Dhamma right there.
Mm.
What he was teaching Bahia is to leave yourself out of it. That's the essence of mindfulness, which is kind of contradictory to what we would think mindfulness is and often how it's taught. Mindfulness, modern mindfulness, is often taught to establish the self in whatever you're doing, where the Buddha says, there's no self here anyway. You can't, and that, again, this isn't implying that there's no such thing as a self, is to not create an identity over what's occurring. And what is seen, there's only what is seen. And a good example of that, I remember I taught a class years ago. I was very cute then. I had an apple sitting in front of me, a green apple. And I asked the group, I said, describe that. And people went through, well, it's an apple. And some people said, I don't really like green apples. I didn't ask you that. And some people talked about the apple pie they might make with it. I didn't say that. And when I see a green apple, if I've had a bad experience with a green apple, maybe I bit one and it had a worm in it, I may never want another green apple again, would I? That's a conditioned mind. Of course, that precludes. Ogmandino gave this. I don't know if anybody knows who Ogmandino is. A rather obscure, but a wonderful writer. He's been dead quite a few years now. Kind of a spiritual successor. That's how I got into him. But he told this story about a cat will jump up on a hot stove and burn itself, and jump off, and that cat will never jump up on that stove again. We do the same thing. Something happens to us. And because we've taken it personally, we create aversion about that experience. And that now clouds our experience of life. It doesn't have to be necessarily that same experience. It doesn't have to be a green apple. I might start projecting that into green apples or red apples or bananas or oranges or anything else because of that initial condition. I've created an unreasonable view of the world that doesn't allow for things to be different. And so that's another example of karma now. That karma that I've made out of that poor decision is now affecting the rest of my life. Nothing I can do about it. Thank you. Tony, good to see you again this morning. I'm glad you could join us again. Tony joined us from Chicago, and he's going back next week. But.
Good morning. Take the wind with you. So karma. Understand what you were taught, what you said.
You can say anything you like to, and you don't have to say anything if you don't want to. Then that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, mostly I like to. When I think about karma, I just think about what I'm doing, or what's going on in my head. Maybe like anxiety, I tend to have a lot of anxiety. Bring up the idea of karma. It's like, yeah, I've been anxious for my whole life, and if I just give into it, then it's just gonna keep going. But if I rest in awareness, if I feel it, come back to the breath, maybe cultivate metta, then I'm creating new karma that's diminishing anxiety and bringing something new into being. And bring me further along this path to freedom.
Yeah. A beautiful description. Thank you, Tony. Because that is it's the most important thing is the present quality of our mind. And if our minds are agitated, we come back to the breath. And like in meditation, when we do that in meditation, coming back to the breath is interrupting our conditioned thoughts, isn't it? It's interrupting our karma. And so in the moment, off our cushions, if we remember to do what Tony just described, we're interrupting the karma that's unfolding in this moment through mindfulness, through true mindfulness. That's how the Dhamma works. Thank you so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, give him a gold star.
Yeah.
Maybe, I think even two. And that might be the first two gold star. Thank you, Tony. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning.
Oh, I promised Lorna I was going to start at the back and work forward, but maybe next time. So, good to see you, Anthony.
You too, and everyone. Karma is, I really get that part of it. I mean, there's a lot of things I'm not, you know, really solid on. Like sometimes I forget the five clinging aggregates or the Eightfold Path, but karma makes a lot of sense to me because it's so practical to life. It's like how you approach things. If you're in an airport and your plane is delayed 2 hours, you can get really aggravated about that and then ruin your entire day. Or you can just look at it as an opportunity to watch a movie or something that you haven't seen, or read your book and be at peace with it, or even just meditate. So, and it really applies to like everything in your life. How you approach it is how you manifest your destiny. You know, you could apply it to be sitting in traffic. I mean, you can find joy in everything that you would be conditioned to think isn't enjoyable. So I really like the fact that you associate it with intention, because I never really made that connection before. Because one of the things I'd like to do in my life is set an intention for each day. And I always say, oh, that's a good idea, and then I don't do it. But if you set an intention, it's a way to sort of push out good karma for the day, you know, if you really pay attention to your intention. So I like that. And I think that karma exists on different levels. Like, I think there's inherited karma, because if abused children often become abused parents. And the reason is because of this perpetual cycle of abuse that continues. So I think there's inherited karma. I think there's collective karma. Like right now we're in a political, you know, storm of collective karma. You know, one side against another. We actually have half the country who thinks Donald Trump is great and half the country who thinks he's horrible. You know, and it's caused a lot of bad collective karma on both sides.
Yeah.
So I see it on many levels also.
Thank you, Anthony. Were you finished?
No, I also wanted to say, I love the flowers, because I was looking at it and I realized that every color mirrors the picture above it in some way, including the wood that it's sitting on, and the glass vase mirroring the glass in the frame. And I wondered if that was intentional.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, and before my intention, those flowers were red, but no. I didn't notice it, thank you. The our friend Kevin, not this Kevin, made the frames. Actually, Robin, his wife, did that, so yeah. Nice. And this was from last year's retreat.
Yes, I remember that.
It was maybe 2 years ago, I think that was.
This? Was it?
Mm-hmm.
What happened last year? How can I go? this was, they were making that for VSAC Day, weren't they? And they thank you for noticing that. You're right. Matt brought those flowers. It's a nice touch over the fake ones that I've had there for years. Intention is everything, like the Buddha said. I mean, I said intention is karma, but it really came from the Buddha. I can't take credit for that, but it is. I remember I had a friend of mine many, many years ago who was a long-time practicing Buddhist, and he insisted that intention had nothing to do with Buddhism. But it has everything to do with it. If we understand what right intention is and maintain mindfulness of that in each and every moment, that is how we recognize karma unfolding and diminish its effects moment by moment. Thank you for bringing that up. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. So I was thinking about how you know, when you're teaching as a teacher, or when you teach a class, there's different ways to measure understanding, and there's different levels of understanding, and So as you are learning something, you can usually regurgitate the definition of it first.
That's right.
You know, karma is the past. See, I'm not very good at memorizing, but it's the past, the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by present moment mindfulness.
Yep.
Almost.
That's it.
So that I can do. I explaining it in my own words definitely is where I struggle, but I can recognize it. I can see it when it's happening in myself and in others. So like I get it, but I'm still like to really teach it. I would have a hard time teaching it. Because that's the when you really understand it is when you can explain it to someone else, teach it to someone else, recognize where they're struggling and clear it up for them. So I'm not there yet. What I get about karma is that it is. What has happened, how I reacted to it, affecting how I interpret what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what I enjoyed about today's talk and discussion was that it sort of released me from this, like, grasping for peace of mind that occurs, you know, just from my conditioning. It's like I have to figure this out and change. An active kind of way of like creating change in my life, becoming more of something is something that I'm kind of chasing or grasping for or getting attached to an outcome for. And this discussion kind of helped me let go of that and see that really it's just becoming open to change. It's not resisting change and recognizing what is standing in the way of change so that you can let it go and not, you know, like what you were saying. I mean, I've never didn't try to become awakened before I came here, so I don't have your life experience, but when you were talking about having to try to hold on to views you already had and develop new views, and that doesn't work, and that's because you're resisting change. You can't change and not change at the same time. You can't hold on to one view and have a new view. You have to be willing to have a clean slate all the time.
Yeah, we're always in a process of becoming. Even a Buddha. But they recognize it and they understand it, and there is radical acceptance at that level. Thank you. Another beautiful description. You do understand karma, and you do explain it very well. So, thank you.
It's uncomfortable.
We need to get past the idea. I mean, it's such a part of our conditioned thinking, because of society, that karma is a system of reward and punishment. It just isn't. Karma is a system. Is an impersonal system, if you want to use that word, that shows us the level of our consciousness, what we're holding, consciousness in a small c, what we're holding in mind. That's our karma. And Anthony touched on something too, the karma of our environment that's developed, but that in it, the war going on in our country between the two political sides, it's not the underlying politics that is the karma. It's our experience of the karma of what's occurring is our karma. It's the it's the reactive rhetoric that people are throwing around that is the experience of karma and the constant agitation. But that all that the group karma, you know, the collective group karma in our country, it manifests at only at the individual level. Even though there's people taking sides, they're taking, you know, this side. I'm a Republican, so I'm taking my wrong views, and I'm clinging to the Republicans, and the other side does the same thing. And that's not. You've got to be careful here. I'm not. It's just what's unfolding in the world. And the Buddha described that underlying global, well, national, but then also global karma. Very simply, he said dukkha occurs. And it's occurring at this global level. Why? He figured that out too. Out of ignorance. Out of a lack of understanding. If, you know, everybody understood the Dhamma, wasn't lacking understanding of the Dhamma, there wouldn't be that tension in the world, would there? But you know, who knows if we'll get there. There's a chance. Ken, good to see you this morning.
I'm kind of following along with Jen said that I understand it, but I can't explain it, even though she did a pretty good job. But what I've noticed, especially this past week, so I don't want to get too proud of myself and say I'm doing things right, but you know, I've mentioned each time that I've been here that you confuse the hell out of me when you start talking sometimes.
I try not to, but
I know you don't. Well, last week I tried to compliment you and you yelled at me, so I'm not saying anything nice about you this week.
Did I really yell at you?
Well, you didn't yell at me, but you told me I didn't have to do that every time.
So. Oh, okay.
But what I noticed is when I stop thinking about all this stuff, it starts to make sense.
Yeah.
You know, when I just, like I said, last weekend was a nice weekend. I went home and I did a lot of work in my yard, and I kind of just focused on what I was doing in the moment. And little bits of things that you had said and that I've read started to say, oh, okay, that does make sense. I still couldn't explain it, but it starts to, I start to internalize the stuff. And, you know, now I've noticed throughout the week when I came in, I said, my week, you know, things have been getting better for me. And it's not because I've done anything magical, but because everything is impermanent, things change, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the better. But I think what's really happening is, as I develop my practice, I'm not hanging on to all that bad stuff and worrying about it as much. The stuff, you know, I just starting to be happier with what I have instead of keep striving for, you know, more than I need, I guess is a good way to put it.
Wow. That's a beautiful way of putting it. Thank you. And that's worth the price of admission, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's worth the effort to get. That when the Buddha used that term, when I use the term ehipasiko, that's what he means. You have to have a practical experience of it, and that's what you're describing. And once you have that practical experience of it, that gives you the impetus, the momentum, the intention to continue with it. You know, and it happens pretty quickly. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Nice to see everybody. You asked about karma and rebirth. Anatta's awakened or unawakened experience of dukkha within an Egypt. That's how I view it.
Yeah. That's it. Thank you. The awakening is an escape, ultimately it is, from dukkha. It's as the Buddha described right view as a view that understands dukkha. Doesn't mean that it doesn't occur. When you read the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the sutta of the last 90 days of the Buddha's life, he died of food poisoning, and he describes the experience of that as it wasn't an immediate. He had food poisoning during his process, and he describes the pain of and it's pretty, you know, descriptive of having that and going through it. But he didn't describe it in a way like it shouldn't happen to him. In fact, it goes through the whole story of how the Kunda gave him, probably gave him some bad pork, and he didn't want anybody to make any, even mention it to Kunda, because he didn't want to hurt, you know, he knew that there was nothing there. And so he could have gotten angry at Kunda. How, look at Kunda, killed me. He maintained his equanimity through the whole process and was able to continue to teach the Dhamma too until his final breath. And his final words were, impermanence and decay are relentless. Strive diligently for your own salvation. He didn't teach to appease gods or goddesses or anything else. Work diligently for your own salvation. Joe, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you, John. My understanding is that karma is just kind of our reaction, how our reactions to events color our perceptions going forward.
Yeah, it's a good description of it. And understand that whatever is unfolding and our experience of it is up to us. You remind me of the Bhadakarata Sutta, where Buddha teaches we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. It's the essence of an awakened human being, isn't it? Good to see you this morning. Diane, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. What I go back to is when I am disturbed, when my mind is less than peaceful, this is one of the things that I think I love about the practice is I go back to the metta, the love and kindness, and because my ego has a tendency to, when my mind is less than peaceful, you know, batter the heck out of me, and it's, for me, it's occurring more, you know, there's less time lapse between the experiencing of karma or conditioned thinking and remembering, you know, taking a breath. That taking a breath is wonderful.
Yeah.
And then that brings me back to the gentleness. And then the thing that I have found more than anything is kind of like raking the yard kind of thing is things, so it's like I can't contrive things to happen or consciously make a thought happen. It's more of an intuitive, just a happening, intuitive is, or whatever that means. I'm done.
Thank you. So the important thing to remember is just that if you feel like you're having a bad karma day, it's not. And if you feel like you're being blessed with good karma, you're not. But what you have, or what you can develop through the Dhamma, is a reasonable and realistic view of who you are in relation to the outside world, the three marks of existence. And by that radical acceptance of who you are in this moment, meaning being at peace with who you are in relation to the world, being at peace with the world, is the essence of the Dhamma. And so we can create, if we find that we're agitated in this moment, and we come back, like we've talked about, most of us mentioned it, Tony, come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting our karma, and at least for the moment, we're developing the quality of an awakened mind. Of course, until we're there, we have karma that might knock us out of that for a moment. Remember the Dhamma, come back to the sensation of breathing in our bodies, come back to the peace within us. And we're establishing an awakened mind. We are becoming Buddha. That's why I titled the book that way, but that's why the Buddha just used that term too. He used the word becoming to describe the potential in each moment. And each moment holds that potential. We can either become awakened, keep our minds inclined towards becoming awakened, or we can continue ignorance, and the choice then is to become further ignorant. And it really is the only choice that we have. It's a pretty powerful choice. But that would make sense that an awakened human being would be able to refine his understanding and our understanding to the practical point, to where we have to apply the Dhamma. And it's at that point of contact, like he mentions here. Next week we'll conclude our series this year with the hindrances. The hindrances are something that are often kind of overlooked too. They're such an important aspect of the Dhamma that there's a sutta called the Nirvana Sutta, or Nibbana, which would be the Pali. Nirvana is Sanskrit. Nirvana is the word to describe awakening, but what it translates to in the Pali, Nibbana, means to extinguish. And if you remember the Fire Discourse, the third teaching the Buddha ever gave, he talks about how from ignorance we create these fires of passion for maintaining a self that can't be maintained. Well, Nibbana describes the experience of extinguishing those flames of passion that the Buddha described in his third sutta. And he describes, and this is a very short sutta, Nirvana Sutta, he describes the importance of developing an understanding of the hindrances so that they no longer hinder our development. David mentioned the fetters. They can be called fetters, although it has a slightly different connotation usually. But this is what keeps us from awakening. It's not something that's insignificant, or the Buddha wouldn't teach it, and it certainly wouldn't be given a title as the Nirvana Sutta, the Awakened Sutta, if it wasn't so important. The reason why I'm mentioning that is take care, Diane. Thank you for the pies, too, by the way. The reason why I'm mentioning that is that I'll include the Nirvana Sutta, a link to it. I'm just finishing it up today, probably. It'll be on the website and linked in Monday's email, so you can read it before next week's class. But it's an important sutta. Okay, our retreat's coming up in 5 or 6 weeks, so if you're going, sign up and come. Hope you all can join. And we'll finish with metta, as we always do, with the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.